Never do that.
We need to make haste. Liberal democracy is moving to a form of corporate dictatorship. This is an historic shift, and the media must not be allowed to be its facade, but itself made into a popular, burning issue and subjected to direct action. That great whistleblower, Tom Paine, warned that if the majority of the people were denied the truth and the ideas of truth, it was time to storm what he called the Bastille of words. That time is now. Thank you.
That's John Pilger, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features John Pilger on Lapdogs with Laptops. A vital and independent press is essential to the functioning of democracy. In recent years, media concentration has accelerated. This has resulted in the closing down of many domestic and foreign bureaus and a sharp reduction in the number of working reporters. In pursuit of a juicy tidbit, too many journalists today cozy up to power. They take pride in being called on by their first name at presidential news conferences. They play golf and tennis with high administration officials and are invited to all the important dinner parties. We need a press that will hold the feet of the powerful to the fire and not drink Cabernet Sauvignon with them. Citizens are ill-served by lapdogs with laptops. Our guest today is John Pilger. He was an internationally renowned award-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker. WikiLeaks called him a ferocious speaker of truth to power. Born in Australia, he was long based in London. He was twice selected as Britain's Journalist of the Year. His award-winning documentaries include Palestine is Still the Issue and The Coming War with China. He passed away on December 30th, 2023. This classic from the AR archives was recorded in Chicago in 2007. And now, John Pilger.
So I thought I would talk today about journalism, about war by journalism, propaganda, and silence, and how that silence might be broken. Edward Bernays, the so-called father of public relations, wrote about an invisible government which is the true ruling power of our country. He was referring to journalism, the media. That was almost 80 years ago, not long after corporate journalism was invented. It's a history few journalists talk about or know about, and it began with the arrival of corporate advertising. As the new corporations began taking over the press, something called professional journalism was invented. To attract big advertisers, the new corporate press had to appear respectable. Pillars of the establishment, objective, impartial, balanced. The first schools of journalism were set up, and a mythology of liberal neutrality was spun around the professional journalist. The right to freedom of expression was associated with the new media and with the great corporations, and the whole thing was, as Robert McChesney so put it so well, entirely bogus. For what the public didn't know was that in order to be professional, journalists had to ensure that news and opinion were dominated by official sources, and that hasn't changed. Go through the New York Times on any day and check the sources of the main political stories, domestic and foreign. You'll find they're dominated by governments and other establishment interests. That's the essence of professional journalism. I'm not suggesting that independent journalism was or is excluded, but it's more likely to be an honourable exception. Think of the role Judith Miller played in the New York Times in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. Yes, her work became a scandal, but only after it had played a powerful role in promoting an invasion based on lies. But Miller's parroting of official sources and vested interests was not all that different from the work of many famous Times reporters, such as the celebrated W.H. Lawrence, who helped cover up the true effects of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima in August 1945. "No radioactivity in Hiroshima ruin," was the headline on his report, and it was false. Consider how the power of this invisible government has grown. In 1983, the principal global media was owned by 50 corporations, most of them American. In 2002, this had fallen to just 9 corporations. Today, it's probably about 5. Rupert Murdoch has predicted that there will be just 3 global media giants, and his company will be one of them. This concentration of power is not exclusive, of course, to the United States. The BBC has announced it's expanding its broadcasts to the United States because it believes Americans want principle, objective, neutral journalism, for which the BBC is famous. They've launched BBC America. You may have seen the advertising. The BBC began in 1922, just before the corporate press began in America. Its founder was Lord John Reith, who believed that impartiality and objectivity were the essence of professionalism. In the same year, the British establishment was under siege. The unions had called a general strike, and the Tories were terrified that a revolution was on the way. The new BBC came to their rescue. In high secrecy, Lord Reith wrote anti-union speeches for the Tory Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin and broadcast them to the nation, while refusing to allow the Labour leaders to put their side until the strike was over. So a pattern was set. Impartiality was a principle to be suspended whenever the establishment was under threat. And that principle has been upheld ever since. Take the invasion of Iraq. There are 2 studies of the BBC's reporting. One shows that the BBC gave just 2% of its coverage of Iraq to anti-war dissent. 2%. That's less than the anti-war coverage of ABC, NBC, and CBS. A second study by the University of Wales shows that in the build-up to the invasion, 90% of the BBC's references to weapons of mass destruction suggested that Saddam Hussein actually possessed them, and that by clear implication, Bush and Blair were right. We now know that the BBC and other British media were used by the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, in what they called Operation Mass Appeal. MI6 agents planted stories about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, such as weapons hidden in his palaces and in secret underground bunkers. All these stories were fake. But that's not the point. The point is that the work of MI6 was unnecessary because professional journalism on its own would have produced the same result. Listen to the BBC's man in Washington, Matt Fry, shortly after the invasion. "There is no doubt," he told viewers in the UK and all over the world, "that the desire to bring good, to bring American values to the rest of the world, and especially now in the Middle East, is now increasingly tied up with American military power." None of this is unusual. BBC News routinely describes the invasion as a miscalculation, not illegal, not unprovoked, not based on lies, but a miscalculation. The words mistake and blunder are common BBC News currency, along with failure, which at least suggests that if the deliberate, calculated, unprovoked, illegal assault on defenseless Iraq had succeeded, that would have been just fine. Whenever I hear these words, I think of Edward Herman's marvelous essay about normalizing the unthinkable. For that's what media cliched language does, and is designed to do. It normalizes the unthinkable of the degradation of war, of severed limbs, of maimed children, all of which I've seen. One of my favorite stories about the Cold War concerns a group of Russian journalists who were touring the United States. On the final day of their visit, they are asked by their hosts for their impressions. "I have to tell you," said the spokesman, "that we were astonished to find, after reading all the newspapers and watching TV day after day, that all the opinions on all the vital issues are the same. To get that result in our country, we send journalists to the gulag. We even tear out their fingernails. Here, you don't have to do any of that. What's the secret?" Oh. What is the secret? It's a question seldom asked in newsrooms, in media colleges, in journalism journals. And yet the answer to that question is critical to the lives of millions of people. On August the 24th last year, the New York Times declared this in an editorial: "If we had known then what we know now, the invasion of Iraq would have been stopped by a popular outcry." Unquote. This amazing admission was saying, in effect, that journalists had betrayed the public by not doing their job and by accepting and amplifying and echoing the lives of Bush and his gang instead of challenging and exposing them. What the Times didn't say was that had that paper and the rest of the media exposed the lies, up to 1 million people might be alive today. That's the belief now of a number of senior establishment journalists. Few of them, they've spoken to me about it, few of them will say it in public. Ironically, I began to understand how censorship worked in so-called free societies when I reported from totalitarian societies. During the 1970s, I filmed secretly in Czechoslovakia, then a Stalinist dictatorship. I interviewed members of the dissident group Charter 77, including the novelist Zdenek Urbanek, and this is what he told me. I quote him: "In dictatorships, we are more fortunate than you in the West in one respect. We believe nothing of what we read in the newspapers and nothing of what we watch on television because we know it's propaganda and lies." "Unlike you in the West, we've learned to look behind the propaganda and to read between the lines. Unlike you, we know that the real truth is always subversive." Vandana Shiva has called this subjugated knowledge. One of the oldest cliches of war is that truth is the first casualty. No, it's not. Journalism is the first casualty. When the Vietnam War was over, the magazine Encounter published an article by Robert Elegant, a distinguished correspondent who had covered the war. "For the first time in modern history," he wrote, "the outcome of a war was determined not on the battlefield, but on the printed page, and above all, on the television screen." He held journalists responsible for losing the war by opposing it in their reporting. Robert Elegant's view became the received wisdom in Washington, and it still is. In Iraq, the Pentagon invented the embedded journalist because it believed that critical reporting had lost Vietnam. The very opposite was true. On my first day as a young reporter in Saigon, I called at the bureaus of the main newspapers and TV companies. I noticed that some of them had a pinboard on the wall on which were gruesome photographs, mostly of bodies of Vietnamese and of American soldiers holding up severed ears and testicles. In one office was a photograph of a man being tortured. Above the torturer's head was a stick-on comic balloon with the words, "That'll teach you to talk to the press." None of these pictures were ever published or even put on the wire. I asked why. I was told that the public would never accept them. Anyway, to publish them would not be objective or impartial. At first, I accepted the apparent logic of this. I, too, had grown up on stories of the Good War against Germany and Japan, that ethical bath that cleansed the Anglo-American world of all evil. But the longer I stayed in Vietnam, the more I realized that our atrocities were not isolated, nor were they aberrations, that the war itself was an atrocity. That was the big story, and it was seldom news. Yes, the tactics and effectiveness of the military were questioned by some very fine reporters. But the word invasion was never used. The anodyne word used was involved. America was involved in Vietnam. The fiction of a well-intentioned, blundering giant stuck in an Asian quagmire was repeated incessantly. It was left to whistleblowers back home to tell the subversive truth, those like Daniel Ellsberg and Seymour Hersh with his scoop of the My Lai massacre. There were 649 reporters in Vietnam on March the 16th, 1968, the day that the My Lai massacre happened. Not one of them reported it. In both Vietnam and Iraq, deliberate policies and strategies have bordered on genocide. In Vietnam, the forced dispossession of millions of people and the creation of free fire zones. In Iraq, an American enforced embargo that ran through the 1990s like a medieval siege and killed, according to the United Nations Children's Fund, at least 500,000 children under the age of 5. In both Vietnam and Iraq, banned weapons were used against civilians as deliberate experiments. Agent Orange changed the genetic and environmental order in Vietnam. The military called this Operation Hades. When Congress found out, it was renamed the friendlier Operation Ranch Hand, and nothing changed. That's pretty much the way Congress has reacted to the war in Iraq. The Democrats have damned it, rebranded it, and extended it. The Hollywood movies that followed the Vietnam War were an extension of the journalism of normalizing the unthinkable. Yes, some of the movies were critical of the military's tactics, but all of them were careful to concentrate on the angst of the invaders. The first of these movies is now considered a classic. It's The Deer Hunter, whose message was that America had suffered. America was stricken. American boys had done their best against Oriental barbarians. The message was all the more pernicious because The Deer Hunter was brilliantly made and acted. I have to admit, it's the only movie that has made me shout out loud in a cinema in protest. Oliver Stone's acclaimed movie, Platoon, was said to be anti-war, and it did show glimpses of the Vietnamese as human beings, but it also promoted, above all, the American invader as victim. I wasn't going to mention the Green Berets when I sat down to write this, until I read the other day that John Wayne was the most influential movie star who ever lived. I saw The Green Berets starring John Wayne on a Saturday night in 1968 in Montgomery, Alabama. I was down there to interview the then infamous governor, George Wallace. And I'd just come back from Vietnam, and I couldn't believe how absurd this movie was. So I laughed out loud. I laughed and laughed. And it wasn't long before the atmosphere around me grew very cold. My companion, who'd been a freedom rider in the South, whispered, "Let's get the hell out of here and run like hell." Well, we were chased all the way back to our hotel. But I doubt if any of my pursuers were aware that John Wayne, their hero, had lied so that he wouldn't have to fight in World War II. And yet the phony role model of Wayne sent thousands of young Americans to their deaths in Vietnam, with the notable exceptions of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. Last year, in his acceptance of the Nobel Prize for Literature, the playwright Harold Pinter made an epic speech. He asked why, and I quote him, "The systematic brutality, the widespread atrocities, the ruthless suppression of independent thought in Stalinist Russia were well known in the West, while American state crimes were merely superficially recorded, let alone documented," unquote. And yet across the world, the extinction and suffering of countless human beings could be attributed to rampant American power. "But," said Pinter, "you wouldn't know it. It never happened. Nothing ever happened. Even while it was happening, it wasn't happening. It didn't matter. It was of no interest," unquote. Pinter's words were more than the surreal. The BBC ignored the speech of Britain's greatest dramatist. I've made a number of documentaries about Cambodia. The first was Year Zero, The Silent Death of Cambodia. It describes the American bombing that provided a catalyst for the rise of Pol Pot. What Nixon and Kissinger had started, Pol Pot completed. CIA files alone leave no doubt of that. I offered Year Zero to PBS and took it to Washington. The PBS executives who saw it were shocked. They whispered among themselves. They asked me to wait outside. One of them finally emerged and said, "John, we admire your film, but we are disturbed that it says the United States prepared the way for Pol Pot." And I said, "Well, do you dispute the evidence?" I'd quoted a number of CIA documents and others. And, "Oh, no, he replied. "But we've decided to call in a journalistic adjudicator." Now, the term "a journalistic adjudicator" might have been invented by George Orwell. In fact, they managed to find the only journalist, no, only one of three journalists who'd been invited to Cambodia by Pol Pot. And, of course, he turned his thumbs down on the film, and I never heard from PBS again. Year Zero was broadcast in some 60 countries and became one of the most watched documentaries in the world. It was never shown in the United States. Of the five films I made on Cambodia, one of them was shown by WNET, the PBS station in New York. I believe it was shown at about 1 a.m. On the basis of this single showing, when most people are asleep, it was awarded an Emmy. What marvelous irony. It was worthy of a prize, but not an audience. Harold Pinter's subversive truth, I believe, was that he made the connection between imperialism and fascism and described a battle for history that's almost never reported. This is the great silence of the media age. And this is the secret heart of propaganda today, a propaganda so vast in scope that I'm always astonished that so many Americans know and understand as much as they do. We are talking about a system, of course, not personalities, and yet a great many decent people believe the problem is George W. Bush and his gang. And yes, the Bush gang are extreme, but my experience is that they're no more than an extreme version of what has gone before. In my lifetime, more wars have been started by Liberal Democrats than by Republicans. Ignoring this truth is a guarantee that the propaganda system and the war-making system will continue. We've had a branch of the Democratic Party running Britain for the last 10 years. Blair, apparently a liberal, has taken Britain to war more times than any Prime Minister in the modern era. Yes, his current pal is George Bush, but his first love was Bill Clinton, the most violent president of the 20th century, the late 20th century. Blair's successor, Gordon Brown, is also a devotee of Clinton and Bush. The other day, Brown said, "The days of Britain having to apologize for the British Empire are over. We should celebrate." Like Blair, like Clinton, like Bush, Brown believes in the liberal truth that the battle for history has been won, that the millions who died in deliberately imposed famines in British Imperial India will be forgotten, like the millions who have died in the American Empire will be forgotten. And like Blair, his successor is confident that professional journalism is on his side. For most journalists, whether they realize it or not, are groomed to be tribunes of an ideology that regards itself as non-ideological, that presents itself as the natural center, the very fulcrum of civilized modern life. This may well be the most powerful and most dangerous ideology we have ever known, because it's open-ended. This is liberalism. I'm not denying the virtues of liberalism. Far from it. We're all beneficiaries of them. But if we deny its dangers, its open-ended project, and the all-consuming power of its propaganda, then we deny our right to the true democracy, because liberalism and true democracy are not the same. Liberalism began as a cult of the elite in the 19th century, and true democracy is never handed down by elites. It is always fought for and struggled for. A senior member of the anti-war coalition, United for Peace and Justice, said recently, and I quote her, "The Democrats are using the politics of reality," unquote. Her liberal historical reference point was Vietnam. She said that President Johnson began withdrawing troops from Vietnam after a Democratic Congress began to vote against the war. That's not what happened. The troops were withdrawn from Vietnam over 4 long years, and during that time, the United States killed more people in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos with bombs than were killed in all the preceding years. And that's what's happening in Iraq. The bombing has doubled since last year, and this is not being reported. And who began this bombing? Bill Clinton began it. During the 1990s, Clinton rained bombs on Iraq in what was euphemistically called the no-fly zones. At the same time, he imposed a medieval siege called economic sanctions, killing, as I've mentioned, perhaps 1 million people, including the documented figure of 500,000 children. Almost none of this carnage was reported in the so-called mainstream media. Last year, a study by the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health found that since the invasion of Iraq, 655,000 Iraqis had died as a direct result of the invasion. Official documents show that the Blair government knew this figure to be credible. In February, Les Roberts, the author of the report, said the figure was equal to the figure of deaths in the Fordham University study of the Rwandan genocide. The media response to Roberts' shocking revelation was silence. What may well be the greatest episode of organized killing for a generation, in Harold Pinter's words, did not happen. It didn't matter.
You're listening to John Pilger on Lapdogs with Laptops. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.com.